Good afternoon. So to start out today, we're going to finish up talking about type and file descriptors and read and write. So I have a little exercise here. We have some C code where we create a pipe. We fork a child process that writes to the pipe, writes 0, then 1, then 2, then 3, then 4, up to 9, and then exits. And we have a parent process which reads from that. The question is, what outputs are possible? The parent just prints out what it reads from the pipe. And so since some of you have looked at this before we started, I'll try seeing what are our opinions at this point. So who says the possible best answer here is A, B, C, D, E, and F, everything, okay. So this has to do with exactly how read deals with the scenario that you're asking to read, and not everything you're asking to read is available. So you see here that we have a read is requesting 10 bytes, and this is writing 1 byte 10 times. And read has a policy that it's going to give you what's available if something's available. Otherwise, it's going to wait for something to be available and then give you that. So what exactly you get depends on how far this reader gets before we have the write. So if we manage to write everything before you read, then you can read 0 through 9. If we manage to only write 0, 1, 2, you'll read 0, 1, 2. If we manage to only write 0, you'll read 0. So it turns out that A and B are both right. But you might say, what if you read before we write anything? What if the parent starts writing and the child is delayed? That's possible, but the policy of read is that they decided it just wouldn't be useful to, by default, have read just tell you there's nothing and have you just keep calling it over and over again before you can do anything. The assumption is you're calling read, you care about getting input, you're going to wait for it. If you don't want to do that, you have to do something else. There are other system calls for that. And that means that you won't read nothing. Instead, it will wait until you get the first bit of input at least. It's not that reading nothing wouldn't be a sensible interface. It's not what POSIX chose because they thought that that was not very useful for most programs. So it's not their default behavior. So D is the correct answer. In fact, when I ran this code on my laptop, here's the distribution of outputs I got. From 1,000 files. Yeah?
What controls when the parent process takes over?
The question is, what controls where the parent process runs? So this depends on when the OS decides to switch between processes. And we talked about reasons that might happen. So it might happen because some I/O made it ready. That doesn't seem to be a factor here. It can happen because we have this timer where we just decide at some points in time that it's just been running too long, run the other thing. And the timer is probably the main factor here.
So it's unpredictable exactly.
So question is, it's unpredictable exactly, yes. So for our purposes, it's unpredictable. So we're going to get into today and on Thursday exactly what is the sort of mechanisms we use to decide what we run and when we run it as far as those switching. Yeah, but yes, it's mostly the timer interrupt that's making the decision of when do we run the parent versus the child. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so that's that. So a couple of logistics aside, I noticed, which probably none of you did, that I had the submission site submitting linked to the wrong semester. If you ever looked at assignment descriptions there, there's a big header on the other semester. That's now fixed. Also, I put a Piazza link on the main website. I got some anonymous feedback suggesting that people were having trouble noticing that I did create a Piazza page for this course, which should be linked from the sidebar of Colab above the anonymous feedback. There's also a link on the main website. So hopefully everyone will be able to find that. And last time, besides talking about pipe and read and write, we also talked a bit about shells, and that's where we have assignment with a checkpoint due on Friday, which hopefully you've started. And now we finish sort of talking about the Unix API in full. So we have our process creation with fork, and then if you want to start a different program, you then, after copying your program with fork, use execv to replace it. If you want to wait for a program, use waitkid. For files, we have this open, then read and write, then close interface. And we saw that for some things like pipes, we had an alternative to open, but the rest of the interface was the same. For pipe, we have the pipe call instead of open, but we still have this initial setup before you use it, and then you can read and write your files. And they're identified by these file descriptors, which we learned could be implemented by this just per process array of pointers. And we have ways of manipulating that, which we need because we have this convention that your output goes to file descriptor 1. If you want to change where a program's output goes, you change file descriptor 1. You don't have some other way of telling the program where its output goes. And this allowed us to implement two interesting shell features of redirection and pipelines, which are both part of the assignment, also useful for things like I'm running the compiler, it produces 10 screenfuls of output, where do I put that? Well, I can redirect it to a file, even though the compiler first wants to put it to my terminal. So questions about the Unix API before we talk about scheduling? Okay, so scheduling is deciding what process runs when, and a big part of that is we have to know what processes there are. And XV6 has probably the simplest way of keeping track of this. It has an array. It has the size nproc, which is the max number supported. So XV6 has decided if you want to run more than nproc processes at a time, nproc I think is like 32 or 16, well, you have to recompile and change that constant. Obviously, in a more commercially viable OS, you might not make that a constant. But so just an array of processes. And there's also a lock. We'll talk more about locks when we talk about concurrency and threading later on. But the purpose of the lock is to prevent more than one thing at a time from manipulating a process's state. So for example, we have timer interrupts. And we don't want it to be the case that we're deciding to switch from one program to another, and then a timer interrupt happens, and we decide to do that again while we're already switching. Because we probably haven't written the code to switch from one program to another to handle that scenario of we're switching while we're switching. And our solution is we're going to disallow that, and the lock is going to allow us to do that. That's not going to keep us from trying to do this switch while also already in the middle of going to switching to another program. And generally, we'll use it to make sure we aren't confused about, like, is this program about to go to sleep or not, while we're trying to decide whether to run it next. That will prevent those sorts of confusion with this lock. So now that we know where processes are stored, we can finish up a story we started earlier of how do we start programs initially. And we saw that we had this setup where we created a kernel stack and made it so we could switch to the program. We also have to allocate an entry in this table for it. And XV6 does the simplest thing. It goes through the table and finds an entry that's labeled unused. And if it doesn't find one, it just says, sorry, can't fork. No more processes. Too bad. So then we have another sort of missing hole, which is that I mentioned fork for creating processes, but we know we have to create a very first process. So I know how we allocate the process control block for it, but how do we decide what it runs? And in XV6, the way this works is that there's just a hard-coded program where we have the machine code just hard-coded inside XV6 for this is the first program we run. And that machine code just execv/init, and that's the real first program we run. And the idea is that /init is a user application that understands how to do startup things, and in XV6, it sets up the terminal and runs a shell. And that's how we actually get started. So in addition to this hard-coded code, we need to set up where does execution start. This is setting the program counter. And we need to say where the stack pointer starts. So they just set it to a location that works. And then they mark it as runnable. So you might say, wait, shouldn't we switch to the program? Well, we're not going to do that directly. But we're going to mark it as runnable. And later on, what we'll call the XV6 scheduler is going to scan the list of processes and look for something that's runnable. And because on boot we set up one runnable process, it's going to find one. And it's going to run it. Okay. So we're going to talk about running processes and scheduling them. And we're actually going to talk about scheduling threads. And in XV6, this is perhaps a little confusing because every process has exactly one thread. In more general OSs, this is not true. So we're going to talk about thread scheduling. Our textbook talks about thread scheduling. Textbooks talk about thread scheduling. Thread's the part that runs on the CPU, and the rest of the process might be shared between multiple threads. But in XV6, they only support one thread per process, so they're kind of lumped together. So we have this part of the process control block, which is really the thread control block part. So this part is per thread. And if XV6 supported more than one thread, we'd have like multiple copies of these, one for each thread in the process. But it doesn't, so they're just all together in the process control block. And in general, you can see that these are things we can have duplicates of. So we have multiple stacks in the kernel. We can have multiple states. These states are things like, is it running or not? So one thread can be running in a process and the other might not be. We have registers, because if the process has multiple threads, they could be running on different cores, have different registers at the same time even, and also different reasons for being asleep. And another way of thinking about it is that the thread is like the stack and the registers and the program counter, the information that goes on the CPU, and everything else would be shared between potentially multiple threads. So we have like our open files, our process ID, our actual memory, like the code and the data, the global variables, and so on. Those might be shared between multiple threads. And we'll see more about that when we talk about writing multi-threaded code later. But each thread's going to have its own stack, its own registers, its own program counter. And these threads are what we're concerned about scheduling. So we're going to have a list of all the threads without regard to what process they're a part of. And we're going to choose which one do we run. So I'm just giving this sort of preview of multi-threaded processes. We'll talk more about threads in a lot more detail later. But before I just move on to talking about what thread do we run, questions about this picture here. Yeah. The question is, what do the different colors mean? So the things in light green are things that are stored in the process control block. The things in yellow are like the memory of the program. And the things in blue are like things that would be actually in the CPU. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So, talk about when we run threads, we need to talk about states of threads. And we saw this very briefly when I talked about the process control block. We have these states of running and not. And We can think of this sort of general lifestyle, and this is pretty much the case across all sorts of operating systems, that our threads, we start somewhere, and once they're set up, they become ready. And by ready, I mean that it's something which could be run, but isn't running right now. Meaning that at any time, it would be correct to switch to it, everything's set up so that would work, but it's not running right now, you know, because they have something else to run apparently. So it could be put on a CPU. When things are actually on a CPU, we say they're running. And notice that we can have transitions both from something that's ready to be put on the CPU to running and back to ready directly, that we can stop something running on a CPU even though it can keep running. Presumably, we decided it took too much time. So that's the case where that happens. We also have the state of waiting, which is this is a program which we can't run on the CPU right now because it needs something to happen. So one example is I'm waiting, reading keyboard input. My thread that's reading keyboard input, if it doesn't have any yet, it's going to go into this waiting state until there's keyboard input for it to get. We can't schedule that right away because it's not eligible to run until we can return keyboard input, presumably from the read system call. And we also have this final state of finished, and this is used to represent things which are done, possibly except for being waited for. So in XV6 and in Unix in general, we have this zombie state where we finish the program, but it hasn't been waited for yet. That's what this represents. So this is the view of, this is what each thread does. It goes through these stages, you know, possibly several times. Another way of viewing it is from a more system-wide point of view of what happens to all the threads. And we can think of this as a bunch of queues. I'm going to use the term queue as generally as possible. So these queues I'm talking about might not be ordered in any particular way. So they might not be first in, first out queues. They might be some sort of priority queues or something else. But they're queues in that things go in them and come out them, but in some order. And usually it's going to be approximately first in, first out, but you know, we might have reasons to do something better. And we have here a ready queue. And this is the name we use for things which are ready to run. And we can think of the task of deciding what to run as taking something off that queue. And that decision is just how is that queue ordered? Is it ordered first in, first out, or is it some priority system? We also have queues for other things, like I/O. So we might have someone waiting to access the disk, or waiting for the disk to actually do something before it moves on to the ready queue. And we have things that are just waiting until some event happens, like waiting for a key press to happen, or waiting for a certain amount of time to occur before they wake up. So these are queues that contain just a list of threads, conceptually at least. Though XV6 doesn't implement them in this way. Yes?
Will the I/O queues, wait queues, ready queues all correspond to certain processes? Like, for example, if you have one process, two processes that are waiting, and one needs a keyboard, one needs a mouse, they're going to be in the same order of which process needs which, right, in the I/O wait queues?
So the question is, like, if I have two programs waiting for different types of I/O, are they both on the same queue? So generally, no. This is why I wrote plural queues here. So there's actually going to be multiple of these, one for each type of I/O device. And for things like a keyboard, we might have this decision that the queue can only hold one thread, because only one thread can read from the keyboard at a time. But I'll still call it a queue to be most general. But where queues for I/O really happen are things like hard drives, where all your programs can try to access the hard drive, and we just have to decide what order do we let them do that in. But for many other devices like keyboards and screens, this queue is going to be really boring because we only let one program access it at once. So we have a ready queue and run queue and so on. So something on XV6, XV6 doesn't represent things as queues explicitly. We can think of there being a ready queue, but the ready queue is just really, we have that array of processes, just scan for everything that's runnable. That's a ready queue. IO queues, scan for everything that's listed as sleeping with a particular reason for sleeping. So real OSs, quote unquote real OSs, typically have separate lists for this, but this is just an efficiency thing really, right? We could scan all the processes to find this out. We probably need to track this information in the process control block anyways. So we can't like avoid keeping track of what XV6 is, but having it separately is gonna make things a lot faster. XV6 just doesn't care. They say, well, maybe it's gonna take longer to figure out what's the next thing I can run in the CPU. That's fine. In a real OS, you'll say, I'm gonna make a separate data structure so that's fast. So we're gonna talk about scheduling today, and mostly we're gonna talk about scheduling of the ready queue. So scheduling is basically choosing what thread to remove from a queue. And there are multiple versions of the scheduling problem depending on what queues you have. But we're mostly gonna talk about that queue just before we get to the CPU, even though we have the same problem for like the queue before the disk and maybe other queues that I didn't even show in our system. And to be concrete, like there are other scheduling problems we won't talk about in detail, but I want you to know about them because a lot of the ideas we'll talk about will mostly apply to them. So we'll have some very general things about scheduling, which will apply to everything. And we'll have some more specific things about scheduling for writing things on a CPU, which won't really apply to these other problems. So another example of scheduling, which occurs outside what you might consider an operating system, is batch job scheduling. So if I have a supercomputer with hundreds of cores and we're running programs which need like hundreds of cores each, what order do I run them in? That's a scheduling problem, but it's not like our scheduling problem on my desktop or my laptop where, yes, we have to decide what programs to run and when, but I'm running them on a single core at a time and I'm running them for like milliseconds, not hours or days. And I can easily context switch between them, which is on a supercomputer, that context switch operation is like save everything to disk, which might take like several minutes. There's also, I mentioned, I/O scheduling. So if we have a network device or a hard drive, when do I read or write from that for each program? That's the decision. But here, we're gonna talk about CPU scheduling. So figuring out what runs on the CPU when, and we're gonna be even more specific. We're gonna talk about doing this on a system where programs do a lot of I/O. So this applies to like your laptop, your desktop, your phone. Like programs are doing lots of I/O most of the time. And a big thing we're gonna do with our CPU scheduling is because programs do I/O, I/O generally won't use the CPU. Remember we talked about exceptions that the I/O device tells the OS when there's something to do, like when there's a key press or when the disk is done reading. And this means while we're doing I/O for program A, we can run program B or C or D. And our main scheduling problem is going to be sort of taking advantage of this and being efficient in this kind of scenario. We're also going to talk about something which is incredibly unrealistic today and doesn't apply to modern laptops, phones, or desktops, and that we're going to use a single CPU core. This is just to keep things simpler. And because, well, if you want to talk about scheduling for multi-core, first you talk about scheduling each core individually, and then you talk about how does this not work so well. So I'm not planning on going into what extra stuff you do to schedule on multi-core efficiently. We're just going to pretend you do it by doing single-core scheduling separately for each core, even though in the real world you want to do something a bit better than that. So before I move on to specifically talking about the scheduling. Any question about our scheduling sort of scenarios? We have our target for this lecture and the next lecture, and these sort of other problems. Mentioned the batch scheduling and I/O scheduling. So the interesting thing about scheduling that we're going to eventually get to is going to be the policy. But first, I'm going to go over sort of mechanism stuff. Like, how do we actually find a process to run? How do we switch to it? How do we switch away from it? And so on. You know, the decision parts of that. But the interesting part of scheduling, what we're going to spend most of our time is on the policy, which is deciding what to remove from the queue. But first, I'm going to go through what XV6 actually does in its scheduler. Just how its scheduler works, and then we're going to talk from that about what should it really do to be more intelligent. And something about the XV6 scheduler is you're going to look at it, and you're going to say, we're really talking about policies, and say, there's no policy in here. But that's not really true. The XV6 scheduler, even though it looks like it's doing the simplest possible thing, by doing that, it's made a decision about what it runs next, what order it runs things in, when it switches to things. And that they made one particular decision. We'll talk about, was that a good decision, a bad decision, or is it sometimes good, sometimes bad? And that's what we're going to think about more. But first, we're just going to go through, like, how does the scheduler work? How is it run? And so on. So the XV6 scheduler runs as a separate thread. This is just a design choice that they have a thread which is not associated with any process. It just runs the scheduler. And it runs an infinite loop. In the infinite loop, it looks for a thread to switch to. And then it switches to that thread. And that thread runs for a while, and then that thread switches back to the scheduler. The scheduler continues this loop, looks for another thread to switch to, switches to it, and so on. And the actual process is run for a while, switch to the scheduler thread, and eventually get switched back to. Perhaps right away, if there's only one process that can run, perhaps a lot later. So here's our scheduler code. This is that infinite loop I promised. So, yeah, infinite loop just runs forever. And the loop starts with something we didn't really talk about. It starts with this STI, which is a function which calls the STI instruction, which enables interrupts. And the reason it does this is because we need to make sure, while we're doing this decision, that things like key presses and timer interrupts actually get handled. And it turns out we're going to disable those things later on. And the reason why is because a timer interrupt might change what programs are runnable. And that's going to confuse the code later on that's trying to figure out, can I switch to this program or not? And we don't want to say, I can switch to it, no, I can't, because of a timer interrupt or a key press or something like that. So we want that to be consistent. So we enable and handle interrupts here. And then in the next line of code, we disable them. So we have this acquire and release. And in this block of code between the acquire and release, we ensure that other programs, or more importantly, like interrupt handlers, the trap function, won't run and interfere with what processes are runnable while we're scanning through the list of all the processes. And we're doing what may look like no policy whatsoever. We just scan through all the processes, find one that's runnable. If it's not runnable, we just keep going. If we get to the end of the list and don't find anything runnable, we go back to the beginning and scan from the beginning again. So we're just going through the list in order, round and around, finding a runnable process. And finding, in fact, each runnable process. And then we switch to it. We have our actual context switch function, and there's actually a little bit of setup code, which I'll show on the next slide. So we switch to the program, and then the program eventually will switch back to the scheduler when it's done running for whatever reason. Maybe it's waiting for I/O, maybe a timer interrupt happened. And then we'll continue this loop and look for the next program. If we don't find a program before the end of the array, we go back to the beginning and look for the first program and keep going. So questions about this code? Yes?
When you acquire the lock, are you disabling interrupts or are you just ignoring interrupts?
The question is, when we acquire the lock, are we disabling interrupts or are we ignoring interrupts? So acquiring the lock, one consequence of that is that we're going to do what is called disabling interrupts, which means that the interrupt events still are remembered, but they won't be acted on until we re-enable interrupts. And you might say, well, if we only re-enable interrupts here, how do we ever switch back? It turns out that the program we switch to is going to re-enable interrupts too. Yes?
Can you explain why we need to disable interrupts?
Question is, why do we need to disable interrupts? So we're scanning through the list of runnable processes. So things could happen which change whether a program is runnable or not. And we don't want that code to run while we're scanning through this. And that code can run from interrupt handlers, could change whether something's runnable while we're, you know, trying to maybe switch to it. Yes? So the question is, what happens if we have one process in the table and it's waiting for something? Aren't we going to keep it from getting its event? And the reason why that won't happen is we're going to iterate, find that one process, skip over it, skip over everything, go to here, and re-enable interrupts. And at this point, the key press handler will run and make that process runnable again. Yes? The question is, if we disable interrupts until we release the lock, the interrupt handler goes through them as soon as interrupts, the lock is released. As soon as interrupts are re-enabled, which the lock releasing should do, yes, the interrupt handler should run right after that. Sorry?
Each one that was given to it during the lock.
So the question is, it goes through each one that was given to it during the lock. This is generally what will happen, yes, is that typically in XV6, like, there's going to be some hardware-defined order for when, how they're triggered, but first the highest priority one in the hardware will trigger, and the next one after that's done being handled, and so on. Yes? The question is, what happens if I set a process to not runnable like here? So the question is, if we had to? So the scheduler is going to be constructed, so code in the scheduler, while the lock is held, is not going to change that state. There is going to be other code which might set a process to not runnable. That's going to run by acquiring this lock elsewhere. And we'll see an example of that later. Okay. Other questions? So this is our main scheduler loop. Just goes through the processes in order, keeps scanning the list, switches to everything it finds that's runnable. And the switch is a little more complicated than just switching to the thread. So we have some bookkeeping. So one piece of bookkeeping is that we set the current CPU's notion of what process is running. And if you remember, we had this myproc to retrieve the currently running process from the trap and so on, like for handling system calls. This is how we set up that information. We also have this switch UVM function, which sets the address space, so we have the memory for the correct program loaded before we actually start running it, and we set it as running. And the reason we set it as running, not runnable, is first so we know it's running, and notably if we have multiple cores, we want it to be the case that a scheduler running on another core won't try to run something that's already running. That'd be really bad. really confusing. So then we switch to the kernel thread of the process, and that kernel thread will run and then probably return to user mode like we discussed with context switches. And after we switch to the kernel thread of the process, it's going to switch back to us eventually, back to the scheduler. And we run this switch KVM function, and this changes the address space back away from the process to unload its memory. And we do a final bit of bookkeeping of remembering that we aren't running a process right now. So if an interrupt happens, we aren't confused about is a current program running or not. No, it's not. So questions? This, yeah.
Why is the program not running?
So one example is the scenario where every program is waiting for input. We want to be the case that when an exception happens during that, we don't think something's running right now. So that, in fact, does happen quite often. Like, everything's waiting for input. Well, no program's running, but we're still running the scheduler. And we have to put something on the CPU to run. So the scheduler is that. It's a loop that's going to run. Yeah?
So does that mean the schedule like doesn't run while a process is running? It'll wait for the process to finish and then try to schedule the next process?
So the question is, the scheduler doesn't run while a process is running?
Like you said that like after switch, when you return and switch back, that's when we have to deallocate the memory. So does that mean...
So this switch KVM doesn't deallocate the memory, but it makes it inaccessible. But I'm not sure. But you're saying it doesn't run while...
So it says after you run the process until it's done, we end up here. I guess I didn't understand what that meant.
After we run the process until it's done doing whatever it was doing, done using the CPU. That's what I mean. So like maybe it's not like entirely finished, but it's done with the CPU. For whatever reason, maybe it ran out of time, maybe it's waiting for IO, but for some reason it doesn't want the CPU anymore. Yeah.
So the XP6 scheduler is it's responsible for switching from user to kernel memory. I assume KVM stands for like kernel virtual memory.
So the question is the XP6 scheduler is responsible for switching from user to kernel memory. So conceptually, yes. It's responsible for changing the address space mapping. Yeah. In case, the question is, which switch here?
Yeah, that switch fails, then you just set this thing to running, but you're never able to...
So this switch, you're saying? So if this fails, so this does not fail. This never fails. And the reason we know it never fails is because we checked that the program was runnable beforehand. So if this doesn't work for some reason, someone else screwed up by setting the program as runnable. And they shouldn't have done that. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So it says that on the next slide that the should have changed the process state before coming back. Is that done like in the timer interrupt?
So the question is where. So I mentioned here that it should have changed its process state here. Sorry, it's in the comment before coming back. Like, where does it happen? I'll show you the code which does that in a bit. So that's going to be done in the timer interrupt and other places we run the scheduler. Other questions? So to get to that, let's talk about switching to and from the scheduler. So our basic procedure is first, we're going to acquire the lock on the process table. The reason we're going to do this is we're changing what programs are runnable. And we don't want to do that while the scheduler might be running or might be invoked, and get confused about what's runnable right now. So first, we lock the process table, make sure no timer interrupts come in and make us not runnable while we're trying to also make us not runnable. So it happens twice, and who knows how that works. So we're not going to do that by acquiring this lock, disabling interrupts. So we're the only one changing what programs are runnable right now. And then, after we do that, we mark the current program that we're switching away from as not running. And depending on why we're switching away, we might mark it as runnable, we might mark it as waiting, we might mark it as finished, but regardless, we're going to mark it as not running. Because if it's going to keep running, that's because the scheduler is going to decide to run it again. If the scheduler doesn't decide to run it, it's not going to be running. And then we actually switch to the scheduler thread, and it goes through a list of processes, finds something that's runnable, if there is anything. So it could potentially find the same program, it could potentially find another program, but it makes that decision, and it's out of our code. So then later on, the scheduler will switch back for some reason. It will decide, go back through the list of processes, find this is runnable right now. And at this point, the process table lock will be held. We saw that we acquired that to keep other things from manipulating it. And the current thread will be marked as running. So before we start running the rest of the application's code, we're going to release that process table lock. So now timer interrupts and so on will work again. So questions about this procedure? Yes. So the question is, why do we switch to kernel mode? So I guess I should be clear about, so switch to kernel mode where? Show me on
KVM.
Switch KVM. So the switch KVM, this is not a switch to kernel mode. This is change the address space to only include kernel stuff. So here, this is the change the address space when we switch UVM space to have kernel and user stuff because we have a particular program we want loaded. But the kernel stuff is in fact always loaded in memory and the scheduler code always runs in kernel mode. Does that clarify things? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So let's look at first a case of switching, being switched to from the scheduler, scheduler switching to us, the first time a program runs. So I mentioned when we start a new thread, we have this special fork grant function, which I said finished setting up a thread. One of the things it does, gets switched to, it releases the process table lock, then goes back, returns to the user application code, starts running the program after fork. Okay. We also have code for switching to and from the scheduler from timer interrupts. And I mentioned that there was this yield function we saw called from trap. And here's the source code to the yield function. It gets that process table lock before it changes what programs are runnable. It marks the current process as runnable and not running anymore. And then switches to the scheduler. The scheduler maybe switches to some other things. And later on, the scheduler will switch back to the thing which yielded from the timer interrupt and returns from there. Yeah. The schedge function is just a switch call to the scheduler. That's all it does. Questions on here? So that's our timer interrupt. We also have operations for waiting for something. And this is done with a sleep function. And what this does is it first acquires that process table lock. because we're changing what programs are runnable. And then it sets the current process as sleeping, and also remembers what it's waiting for, which is stored as this chan for channel. Because they're thinking of IO, even though not everything's waiting for IO. And then switch back to the scheduler. And the scheduler eventually will switch back to the sleep function. You might say, well, why would it do that? It's not runnable. Something else is going to change the state to runnable. And I'll show you that code on the next slide. And when that something else changes the state to runnable, the scheduler will decide, OK, now we can switch to this and run it. So questions here? Yes. The question is, when I've switched to the scheduler, doesn't the sleep function still have this lock? Yes, that is true. But that's OK, because the scheduler will eventually release that lock if it needs to. Or alternately, like when we're going to switch, say, to a program that just started, and it will release the lock. Or we're going to switch to a program that just had a timer interrupt, and it's going to release the lock. So it's fine, but we're doing something which, if you're used to locks from elsewhere, you might say, gosh, I expect this acquire to be released by this release. Our acquires and releases aren't in the same piece of code. But we are like calling release exactly once for every acquire. Does that answer your question? Okay. But yeah, that's a good question. So we have, every time we call acquire, we call release, but often from a different thread. It's just the design XV6 has chosen. It's kind of something you often have to do when you have a scheduler. You have this, because you want to have something, you know, have exclusive access to something while you're doing a context switch. Yes? The question was chan is. Chan represents the thing that's being waited for. So on our next slide, we have the code which is going to set something that was marked as sleeping as runnable. And what that code's going to do, it's going to take a chan value and just scan for every process waiting for that particular thing. So for example, if this is handling a key press, there's going to be a value of chan representing the keyboard. And we'll just look for what program's waiting for a keyboard using that. In a faster OS, we probably have a table for everything you'd wait for rather than scanning all the processes. Other questions? So here, this is our corresponding wave of code that sets something as sleeping to runnable. Notice that this just sets something to runnable. It doesn't run it. It doesn't invoke the scheduler. XV6 has made a choice. They mark it as runnable. They don't run it right away. The scheduler's going to get to it eventually, and that's fine. You might say, well, we really should run it right away. Yes, that's a good idea. It's just not what XV6 did. OK, so questions? Here, yeah.
Why are there no locks in this?
So question is, why are there no locks? That is a good question. So this function is called after calling acquire ptable.lock. That's why. So the function which calls this function gets that lock. But yes, in fact, you do need the lock. Yes?
Does XV6 guarantee that every process is eventually run?
The question is, does XV6 guarantee that every process is eventually run? Yes. Every runnable process is eventually run. Other questions? Okay. So talked about how the XV6 scheduler and internals work. And XV6 has some choices that not every OS makes. So XV6 has this separate scheduler thread running this infinite loop. And what this means is that the scheduler is actually keeping some state on the stack. It's keeping this process P, which is the current one we're in the list, and we just keep going down the list. Whereas if we were trying to implement this without a separate thread, we need to keep track of that separately somehow, which wouldn't be hard. But it's a separate thread. But this means it's, while it's simpler and also kind of maybe easier to write the scheduler, it's a bit slower. So most OSs don't have a separate thread. And the reason it's slower is we're calling the switch function twice instead of once to go from one process to another. Whereas the optimal way, we would call it exactly once. Also, it scans the process list to find sleeping, waiting, etc. threads. It doesn't need to do this if you have kept separate data structures. They just didn't want to manage a separate set of data structures. And another big thing is that the XV6 scheduler has a scheduling policy. It has a very explicit choice about what program runs next. And it's even a policy which has some very nice things to defend it. Like you mentioned, it always guarantees programs run. Not every scheduling policy does this. But the policy is very integrated with how the scheduler code is written. There's not like an easy way of changing the scheduler code to implement another policy and keeping it in the same structure. So, what's the scheduling policy for XV6? It's whatever's next in the list. And I told you that this is not a horrible answer, but it's probably not the best answer. So we're going to talk about sort of better answers in a bit. Before I move on, questions about sort of these issues? Yes?
Just a general question. All of these weird, sometimes bad choices XV6 makes, is it old or because it's just like simple?
Question, these choices that XV6 makes, are they because it's old or it's simpler? It's probably a combination of the two, probably mostly because it's simpler. Like this style of writing the scheduler, I think, is almost certainly simpler than writing it without a separate thread. And I think that's true of most of the decisions we've seen. Other questions? Okay. So, talk about policies. So, we're going to want to talk about like what's the best answer for what's a good scheduling policy. And to know that, we have to think about what do we actually care about. You know, so if I care about having the simplest possible code, maybe the XV6 scheduler is great. Great policy, simplest code. But that's probably not what we really care about. So I'm going to talk about what are good ideas for scheduling, and I'm going to use some simplifying assumptions, which might seem really bad. So we're going to say we have like one program per user, one thread per program, and the programs are independent. And all of these are false on real systems. All of them. Typically, we have like one user with many programs. The programs are like talking to each other. The programs have multiple threads. I'm going to ignore all these issues. We're going to take this simple 1970s version of the problem. Just to start out, we'll have to think about how much of this really applies to more general scheduling. It turns out a lot will. A lot will work on our real laptops and desktops. But we're going to start this toy scenario. And if we think about how programs behave, there's this useful model under this sort of one thread per program, is that programs have this alternating behavior, that they do some computation, and then they have some I.O., and they do some more computation, and then they have some I.O. And classic examples are like a shell. Your shell spends a lot of its time waiting for a key press. You practice a few keys, you press enter, the shell does a bunch of work, and then it waits for something again. Or a drawing program, like you scribble something on the screen, it does a bunch of work to make that happen, and then it's just waiting again. Or your web browser, like it's waiting for the network, it's waiting for your mouse clicks, and after each of those things, it does a bunch of work, maybe a lot of work, maybe it's a really complicated web page, and then like it waits again. But so we have, regardless, this behavior where we do a bunch of work, then we wait for I.O. When the I.O. happens, now we have another bunch of work to do. And I will call the bunches of work we have to do CPU bursts, which alternate with I.O. And this is going to be our model of how programs work. And you can legitimately say this doesn't reflect every program I run. And indeed it doesn't, but it's a useful model because it has It reflects a lot of the programs we care about, especially on things that are like desktops or laptops or shared like workstations you log into. Like, programs often really do look like this. And this is also a useful model because this has a direct correspondence to something we care about, which is how useful are the programs to people, humans, who are the ones like typing things at the keyboard. Because we have like input being typed at the keyboard in our model of what our programs are doing. So maybe we can think about how useful is it for someone typing at a keyboard. Now, if I'm talking about these little bursts of CPU, we can actually measure them. So someone in 1966 took a bunch of measurements of the amount of compute time from when a command was entered until the next command prompt. So that's an approximation of how long are these compute bursts. And we have this kind of log scale down here in compute ticks, which are 15 milliseconds. So we have things which took less than 15 milliseconds, less than 30 milliseconds, all the way up to seconds. And this is actually typically what we see, is that we have most things are very short, like tens of milliseconds or less. And we have a significant number of things which take a lot longer. And we're going to use this observation when we're deciding what schedulers are good or bad. Think about, what does this mean for my user? Now, you might complain about this picture because this is from 1966. And probably things are different now, but they're not as different as you might expect. So here's 1990, which is still old. Hard to get recent data for this without collecting it yourself. And then I need to find a system that's doing something interesting. But this is from 1990. And we have these buckets, which are, this is basically a log scale. So we have like this, we have some things which take several seconds. And we have most things are in the single digit millisecond range. This is most of our CPU bursts. So most programs, you know, most of the time we see a program run for like a millisecond and then wait for more I/O. But sometimes we have programs which take many seconds before they wait for I/O. This is the typical distribution we see. And these are on things like desktops or things with terminals. So other types of systems might not work this way. Like if you think of the servers at google.com, probably don't have a distribution like this. But this is what we see in sort of desktop-like environments. And we see that typical CPU bursts are going to be milliseconds. So talk about these CPU bursts. And to talk about scheduling, we're going to talk about scheduling these CPU bursts. So our view is that we are going to have a ready queue, and it has a bunch of things which are ready to run a CPU burst. And our challenge is, what order do we run those CPU bursts in? And to simplify things, we're going to kind of assume that we have multiple things all ready at once. In real systems, we know that, well, the key press finishes at one time and the network finishes at another, so they're not exactly going to be ready at once. But we're going to say, let's say they're all ready at once just to simplify our problem. So we have a bunch of things want to run at once, and we have to make a decision. Which one do we run? And we don't just want to choose, you know, randomly. We want to make the best choice. What is the best choice? So to do that, we're going to have some metrics for deciding that. And our metrics, well, we have choices. And I have there's more than three listed here. There's three listed here. One of them, we're going to have some variants that are related. I'll talk about in a second. So one metric we're going to talk about is turnaround time. Confusingly, this is also known as response time, which is also a name for a different, very related metric. I'm going to try to use turnaround time, and I'll talk about the different related metric in a second. But this is the time from when I press a key, or when Some I/O happens when something comes in the network until that CPU burst finishes. That's our turnaround time. We can think of from requesting the application to do something to when it actually finishes that. And this is a very attractive metric for things like desktops, because we can think of this as the user perceived response time. Is that always going to be true? Maybe not. But you know, if I press a key and we finish that CPU, presumably that's when I'm seeing my output, right? So this is an approximation of how quickly do I see my output. And we would say, well, if I can make that really low, that I usually see my output really quickly, that's great. That's a better system for me to use, and I want to achieve that goal. We have some other goals. So one goal is throughput. So throughput is the total amount of work we get done. And you might say, well, we have one core, because we're assuming one core, that's how much work we can get done. But it doesn't quite work that way. And one big reason is going to be what we'll call overhead. So one type of overhead is going to be context switching. Context switching takes time. If we manage to achieve really high response time by context switching all the time, we'll get less work done overall because we're spending so much time context switching. Now, a third goal we might have is fairness. So in our one program per user model, fairness is kind of intuitive, that each user gets the same amount of stuff. In our one user running multiple programs, that alternative view that's like more realistic, fairness might mean like my terminal still gets to run even though my web browser has a lot to do. Now, fairness is a very subtle thing and very hard to define, because even though we have an intuitive notion that some things are obviously less fair than others, actually coming up with a definition that deals with questions like, well, if I run this program less, but it has less work to do, is that fair? And other questions like that is very tricky. So something about all these metrics is that they're generally in conflict. That a lot of our strategies for lowering turnaround time are going to lower throughput. A lot of our strategies for increasing fairness are going to lower throughput or lower turnaround time. So we're going to have to choose what's important to us. And that's just how things are going to be in this scenario. So before I move on, questions about these metrics? Okay, so a note about response time and turnaround time. So when I say turnaround time, I mean, let's say I have a program, it's waiting for input, then that input comes in and it's ready, then it runs for a while. This, the time from when it becomes ready, we could have run it right away, but we didn't. We saw XV6 would do this, it would just mark it as runnable, wait for the scheduler to look at it. Until when it finished doing the work it needed to do and started waiting for I/O again, that's turnaround time. And Anderson Dahlin calls this response time. And you might say, okay, so why don't you call it response time? So there's something called wait time, which is the time from when a program stops waiting for input to when it actually finishes running that it's not on the CPU. So you can think of it as the turnaround time minus the running time. And this is what Arpeggio de Sceaux, the other textbook I recommended, calls response time. And you can see that these definitions, like, they're in the same area, but they mean different things. I'm going to try to use the terms turnaround time and wait time to be distinctive. And this is a real problem. Yes, people in the real world mean a lot of things by response time. If you want the precise definition, you have to check what they're looking for. Now, turnaround time is probably our most important measure from the standpoint of interactivity. And therefore, something we'll spend a lot of time thinking about, how do we make this good? And one thing we have to do is that, well, actually we have like lots of little samples of turnaround time for each program, and we need to decide, well, what's the relative importance? And we're commonly going to start with the mean turnaround time or the total turnaround time as the thing we're optimizing. So if we have 10 different programs running, each of which is waiting for 10 different types of I.O., and they all wake up and have different things to do, we'll take the mean time each of them waited or the total across all of them. And I'll give some examples of that probably next time, maybe later. So that's what we're going to be optimizing. And conveniently for this confusion with response time, that's the same as optimizing the wait time. Because for the mean, it works the same. And for the total. Now, you might say, should we really be looking at the total? Doesn't this mean that one weird program is going to make us do bad things? And that's a legitimate complaint. But we're going to have to start somewhere. And the simplest thing is just take the mean. Also means that we can like do math and prove that things work, which is going to be harder for other types of averages. So turnaround time, we can think of in the CPU burst land as the time to start the next I/O. So in addition to being good for responsiveness, we can think of this as good even for like talking to a network, because it means that we can fully utilize the network, for example, if we ask the network for the next thing right away. So this is like a really common goal, even not on a desktop. And the same sort of metrics might apply to other scenarios. This is, I told you, like we're talking about CPU scheduling, but our ideas will apply elsewhere. So if we think of like scheduling batch programs, turnaround time is when do I submit my multi-hour long program to when it finishes? That's also a reasonable metric, even though we'll talk about the CPU idea. Then I had throughput. And the main problem with throughput is going to be context switch time. So here I'm running A, then B, then A, and I have a context switch. And I'm saying the context switch takes 0.5 units of time. We'll talk later about like empirical measurements for how long does a context switch take, but this extra time is what we're concerned about with throughput, is having as little of that as possible so we're getting the most out of our CPU. And when we're talking about throughput, we're talking about useful work which is lost not just because of the actual cost of changing the registers for a context switch, but things like cold caches, that if I kept running A all the time, then I get a lot better use of the L1 cache than if I switch away to B and evict a lot of the things A was working on from that cache. And that effect is going to be a loss of throughput, that A is going to get less work done in the same amount of time. And we also have things like not starting I/O and so on. And for fairness, we're going to talk about treating programs equally. So here, I have two possible schedules. Which one's more fair? Top one? Bottom one? Yeah. So here it's intuitive, but there's going to be cases where maybe this is not intuitive. Okay. And defining this formally is actually, there's several definitions which give you slightly different outcomes. Questions about our scheduling metrics? Okay, so since we talked about metrics, let's look at an example here. So here I have three different programs. I'm saying they're all ready to run at the same time. And they have this pattern where they use the CPU, and in the case of A, also wait for some I/O. And I have three different schedules. I'm asking, so which is better for throughput, turnaround time, fairness, and fairness, we'll maybe talk about responsiveness after that. So check with your neighbor, see if you see what you think. Did I can't count, can I? I see that I goofed here, and that C should not be there. Can't add. No. Okay, so who has a proposal for which is best for throughput? And I'm sorry, I just can't add up 1 + 3 = 4, so I have an extra block of C, which shouldn't be there. Who thinks has an opinion about which is best for throughput of these? Back there? So you're saying one's probably best for throughput because we have the least context switches. We have, in one, we have 1, 2, 3 context switches. In all the others, we have more than 3. And context switches are our biggest source of overhead. You have less of them. So yes, I agree that probably should have the best throughput. So how about fairness? Who thinks has an opinion about which one's best for fairness? Yeah.
I'd go with number 2, fairness.
Okay.
Because you could argue about 3, but since it doesn't run me until like the middle, I would say 2 is more fair.
Okay. And your complaint about 3 is 3 is like, it's kind of close, but B is like really let down. So that would be a convincing reason to say it's not fair. And this is, many definitions of fairness will in fact come to the same conclusion that wait, B is really disadvantaged, that seems bad. But there are some definitions which would say, which would probably consider 3 more fair. So fairness is either 2 or 3. So one case for 2 is that 2 finishes B faster, given that B had less work to do. That seems like a good thing. How about mean turnaround time? Or any ideas for that? Or responsiveness, just like generally, so, yeah.
I think 1 is turnaround time because there's the least amount of time between starting and ending each process.
So you're saying 1 is the least minimum turnaround time, mean turnaround time, because there's least time between starting and ending. So turnaround time, this is a bit tricky. We're going to add up for each program. So the turnaround time for B is this, is that. The turnaround time for A is this. And the turnaround time for C is this. And we're asking, is that going to be lower than, for example, here? The turnaround time for B is here. The turnaround time for A is here. And the turnaround time for C is here. And I think I agree with you that it looks like the mean probably is for 1, is lower. And we'll talk more about that next time when we talk about our two simplest scheduling algorithms and look at how they affect things.